Thank you. That was beautiful.
Hi, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. How you all doing? Well, it's a pleasure to be here this afternoon. I want to thank the committee for inviting me back. I think I've been here to the convention 3 times, and it's always very exciting. And let's see, my sobriety date is December 7th, 1964, and I've had the same sponsor for the whole time. So I'm a very lucky guy. So that means in a week or so that I'll have 40 years, and it caused me to reflect on what is it all about, that somebody would stay here. So what I'm going to try and do this afternoon is to tell you what I've been thinking about. And what I think our spiritual message is, and what the heart of the deal is for us as individuals. I saw a movie recently about something about a treasure, national treasure or something like that, and the family, one of these families in it, had this treasure map for generations, and they just sought this treasure. And it came down to where they actually find it during the movie. But these generations had just had this belief that this an unbelievable treasure, and they kept finding clues, and then they'd move on, and they'd move on. And I started thinking about how exciting that is to have a treasure map. And I was thinking about, you know, if there were just 2 guys, and they're both about 43 years old, and they both are in the same car, and they both get killed in a car crash. And one of them had been, let's say, an electrician all his life, and he did reasonably well. Couldn't say that he loved his job, but he did it, and he had a couple of kids, and he kind of looked upon life as something you got through. And the other guy, his family had the treasure map. Now, he never found it, but he was looking for it. And in order to survive, he had to get a job. He was like a part-time this and a part-time that. And he spent a great deal of time thinking about this treasure and how to get it. And in a way, he was a true seeker. And he never found it because he died. So the question is, who had the better life? Now, I don't know about you, but I would rather have been the guy with the map. He had a dream the whole time. He had this sense that there really was something wonderful, that if he kept on looking and could get closer, and as a result of that, his life was much more exciting than the other guys. And so we come in here, and we come to this step where it says we came to believe. And what I'm thinking is how important that was for me, was to actually believe. When you get, you read Paradoxes, that's such a wonderful thing, because that's the whole deal in the spiritual world, are these paradoxes. And believing is such a powerful thing. In the material world, we say seeing is believing. But when you get in the spiritual world, believing is seeing. And you aren't going to see anything until you believe it. And so if we come here and don't believe that the steps are going to cause this transformation in us, it ain't going to happen. You follow what I'm saying? And so eventually I think I took the steps that I didn't believe in. You know what I mean? I just took them. And as I'm taking them, I'm starting to believe. I see that other people have had these changes. And so I think what I want to lead up to eventually is talking about how important believing is. But for those of you that are new, we don't get to believing just because we were sitting out in the streets and go, you know what I need? I need to go believe in something. That doesn't really happen. None of us got here because of that, and I didn't get here because of that. And yet, we all ended up focusing on this same thing with all these different backgrounds that we have. And I don't suppose that, alcoholics, before we start drinking, are substantially different. I think we are more uncomfortable than a lot of other people, but I think every person is wondering in the long run, what is going on? You know what I mean? You read about people who get to age 45 and they're reasonably successful, and then they sit back and go, what the hell have I been doing for 45 years? And go out and run off to Mexico or something, you know, just because this they can't understand why they work so hard and nothing seemed to happen. And so when we look at the disease of alcoholism, there are many, and I'm saying this for those of you that may be new, there's many ways of describing alcoholism. You know, you can say, well, we have an allergy to alcohol and we think about it all the time and that's our problem. But if that was the problem, then it would go away when we stopped drinking. But it doesn't go away, does it? You know what happens when you stop drinking? You're sober all the time. All the time. You're sober in the morning, you're sober at night, and there's no break coming. This is going to go on for weeks and months and years of just being sober. So perhaps the disease itself exists in us when we're sober. That it is an incredible discomfort. That the problem had nothing to do with the damage caused by drinking. It was already there. And it was fixed by drinking. Drinking was the great relief from what was going on inside of me when I was sober. So what was going on inside of me? You know, we can go to psychiatrists and we can go this and we can go, well, I had this childhood and this cat left and it broke my heart. Or I got beat up. Or I didn't get beat up. Or my family was too rich and we were spoiled. Or my family was too poor. It could be all of these things. But if we're alcoholic, that probably isn't what the real problem is. So if we look to the program to see, how does the program describe our problem? Now, we've been many places before we come to AA where people told us what our problem was. I don't know about you, but I was always sitting in front of somebody who was looking down at me, and he was telling me, you know what your problem is? And then he'd start in, you're a self-centered, lying, no good, whatever, and I'm sure you've all had that happen, where you're sitting out there and somebody's telling you what your problem is. And you come to AA, and we do, you know, if you're new, I'll tell you what your problem is. It's a problem you never heard of before. Your problem is lack of power. Now, we never heard that one before we got here. Your problem is lack of power. But when you think about it, life was overpowering us. Somewhere we were told to get along on your own. That if you're a tough guy or gal, you just solve all these problems by yourself. We ought to find that person and kill him. What a terrible bit of misinformation to give to human beings. You're supposed to be able to make it on your own. And you get out there and things are just piling up. And you wonder, God, I need some relief from this. So we may say that you know, this disease is the fact that it's too hard to live out there alone. But that wouldn't really cover it. I think my favorite explanation is to look back at the history and see where how AA got started and how the role that Dr. Young played when Roland Hazard went to see him. There was a millionaire businessman who was not going to be able to take over the family business because he was an alcoholic, and no matter how much money they spent in the United States, they couldn't get him sober. So as a last resort, they went to the famous psychiatrist in Switzerland, Carl Jung, and he stayed there for a year, because he has unlimited money. We can spend all we want to solve this problem of alcohol. So with unlimited money, he stayed there for a year. At the end of the year, Dr. Jung said, well, Mr. Hazard, I've done everything I can for you. You understand your situation. If you keep on drinking, you're going to end up in a sanitarium, because that's what happens to alcoholics back in the late 20s and early 30s. And we'll throw away the key, and that'll be the end. Oh, yeah, I understand that. My God, I understand it. Now, I feel different, and I thank you for the work. And he went back to the States, and he's going through Paris on the way back, and somebody in Paris asked him the wrong question. They said, would you like a drink? And he said, yes, I would, as a matter of fact. very uncomfortable in my skin, and I would like a drink. And so he had a drink and got drunk and was all messed up and went back to Dr. Young, and he said, Dr. Young, I'm back, and I'm drunk again. And it's at this point that we just read chapter 5 where it said that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. Obviously, I think he would fit in that category. And then he turned to Dr. Young, who at that time, was 1930, whatever it was the ultimate help that could be achieved from human beings. And he said to Dr. Young, what can we do? And Dr. Young said, with all humility, there's nothing I can do for you. Now, does that fit into part B? No human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And when he told them, there's nothing I can do for you, that is like pulling the rug out from under you. Because now, there's no help available. I mean, it's just like, oh my God, this is much worse than I thought. And that realization, if you're new, is the ticket in. Because up until we get there, we are rationalizing that it's not as bad as people are saying. But when we get to the point where we say, actually, it's much worse than I've been telling myself, that situation created an open mind. It wasn't going to be open before, but it was then. And we got to part C of chapter 5, the reading of chapter 5, that God couldn't would if he were sought. And so Dr. Young said, there's nothing I can do, but I heard about some alcoholics like you that have been recorded in various books as having found a spiritual solution to this, that they were able to actually have some kind of a spiritual transformation that enabled them to be absolutely happy without alcohol. Now, up until the rug was pulled out from under him, Roland was not going to be interested in a spiritual solution. You follow what I'm saying? That was not his cup of tea. It was only after Dr. Young pulled the rug out and said, there's nothing that can be done for you, and then he said, except for a spiritual solution, then Roland said, well, where am I going to find a spiritual solution? He suddenly got interested in it. Now, he hadn't seen a spiritual solution, but he suddenly believed that this is what he needed. And he went out and found the Oxford group and got sober. They showed him spiritual steps which caused a transformation, which enabled him to be happy without alcohol. Now, this is something that most alcoholics cannot conceptualize. My own self, it's Saturday night, I won't be drinking, and boy, will I be having fun. This is very hard to imagine when you're new into this program. I'm sober, and I'm having a lot of fun. I don't think so. And we go, you don't understand me. I don't get along with people. I'm uncomfortable in my own skin. Yes, you are, and there's nothing you can do about it. On your own, you're going to stay uncomfortable in your skin. But if you will go out and seek the solution will make you comfortable in your own skin. And that's exactly what happened. And, of course, then he passed it on to Bill Wilson's sponsor, Ebby, and then Ebby passed it on to Bill. And we got this wonderful program called Alcoholics Anonymous, where they took the spiritual principles from the Oxford group and tailor-made them for alcoholics. As Bill said, he closed all the loopholes so the drunks couldn't sneak out. And wrote the 12 steps and gave us this. Now, see, for today's thing, we won't call it a program. We'll call it a treasure map. And this map, if we follow it, is going to take us to this incredible treasure. And it did for Roland, it did for Ebby, and it did for Bill. And years later, and this is where I'm getting to the definition. Years later, in the 60s, Bill wrote to Dr. Young to tell him that he actually had been a very key figure in starting AA. And Bill had forgotten to do that. And so he wrote him this letter. I don't know if you remember Roland Hazard, but as a result of your talking to him, he sought out this spiritual thing, the Oxford Group, and that led to AA in 1935, and now we have thousands of people, tens of thousands of people sober. We are in countries around the world, and we owe you, Dr. Young, a tremendous debt of gratitude for getting us off on the right foot. And then Dr. Young wrote back and said, no, I didn't know that. I'm so glad to find that out. I had wondered what happened to Mr. Hazard. I'm so happy to hear this. As you know, in the late 20s and early 30s, when I was treating him, it was not comfortable for a psychiatrist to talk about spiritual things. My colleagues would have laughed me out of my profession. But now, in the 60s, it's much more in. And it's okay to talk about spiritual things. And I can tell you that what I was trying to do with Roland was to cause the equivalent of a spiritual transformation. Because in the final analysis, and this is paraphrasing a little bit what he said, what alcoholism is an inordinate longing for God. Only it's in disguise. We don't identify it as that. We try to figure out what is missing. See, most alcoholics, if you talk to them, will say, there's something missing inside of me. There's something, I don't fit in. I don't belong right. There's something wrong. And the last thing we can guess is that we're too far away from a higher power, from the Creator. That isn't going to come. But guess what? Most of us, somewhere when we're real little, are sent into a church or someplace like that, and they go, by the way, you got to get real close to a higher power. Oh, yeah. You remember that? I heard that. It sounded good in the abstract, but I could tell what I really needed was a new baseball bat. And then I needed a bike. And then I needed ice skates. And then I needed a car. I mean, I could always tell what was missing, and I'm sure all of you could. And then as we got older, well, I need more sex. Well, I need a bigger job. I need more money. That's what I need. It's clear. I can look inside. I can see. And guess who is misdiagnosing the problem? All of us. But we're absolutely convinced that who would know us better than us? I mean, I'm the expert on me, aren't I? And you're the expert on you. And so you go out and you're going to figure out what it's going to take to make you comfortable and happy. Because after all, that's your job, and who could analyze you better than yourself? And so off we go, racing around, trying to find what's going to make us happy. Now, for alcoholics, the game was closed early on when we had our first drink. We suddenly found the ultimate jackpot. I don't know about you, but the first night that I drank, I had a spiritual experience. I suddenly found the world that I lived in to be much more comfortable than the sober world. I found that I was able to be creative, that I could suddenly overcome. No, I didn't overcome. My fears were just taken away. I intuitively knew how to handle situations. Fear of people and of economic insecurity left me. Self-seeking slipped away. Hey, bartender, buy everybody around. They said, what about the rent money you got to pay tomorrow? Hey, don't worry about tomorrow. Live in the now. Eat, drink, and be merry. Tomorrow we could be dead. Hey. We had actually stumbled onto the secret of life. We just had the wrong higher power. But that was the transformation. There was something about the transformation after the third drink that left me speechless. I thought that it was the most remarkable thing that had ever happened in my life. And I've talked to other people who drank at the same time I did, who were not alcoholic, and they don't recall it as being quite that great. They said things like, yeah, it's kind of fun. And I went, kind of fun? This is earth transforming. What do you mean, kind of fun? This is a major event. And they're going, yeah, it's fun. Yeah, it's okay. Yeah, drinking's cool. But so is pizza. So is roller skating. I mean, it was just on a, you know, it was just another happy thing to do. But for us, it was amazing how big a deal drinking was in our view of the world. In Chuck Chamberlain's vernacular, it gave us a new pair of glasses. When we looked at the world through three drinks, this was a great place to live. For the first time in my life, you know, Louis Armstrong's It's a Wonderful World made a lot of sense. And boy, when I had three drinks and they played It's a Wonderful World, I had tears coming down my eyes because I just looked around. Now, the next day when there's no alcohol in my system, I wasn't singing that song. It was back into a black and white, gray, ugly world where I'm nothing and everybody's better than I am and they're all out to get me and I don't trust them, they don't trust me, and what's so wonderful about anything? And as I got growing up and I'm out in the world, and if I feel bad, then you ought to feel bad too. So I would react that way to try and take down anybody who was happy, see if I could ruin their day so we'd all be equal. And then I wondered why there was no harmony wherever I went. So we literally created a very bad world to live in and wondered how that could possibly happen to such a nice person as ourselves. And that was kind of what, now am I drinking? I'll talk more about it tomorrow, but I drank in the Marine Corps as a fighter pilot. And it was very exciting and I had a wonderful time, but I lost my whole career due to drinking and ended up in a straitjacket in the nut ward, locked up for 6 months. And so that's where I started to get an open mind. There's something about a straitjacket that takes that way invincibility feeling away from you, if you know what I mean. So I would occasionally ask people what they thought I should do. And while I'm there, I will say, if there's anybody new, there's only one question you ever need to ask, and you will have the best life you can imagine. That question is, what should I do next? And that's it. Because you are in the place where you can get this guidance. And then your job is to evaluate how well this is working. You never take charge again. You just evaluate how it's going. About every 3 months, go, well, how's it going now that you're not running it? Hey, it's hard to believe, but it's much better. And this is the paradox, that by surrendering, everything suddenly is turning out so much better. So anyway, that's what gave me my open mind to start listening to things that sounded absolutely preposterous. When I finally got a sponsor, who I call a guide, to take me on this treasure hunt. And when I got a hold of this sponsor, I just was willing, because there was nowhere else to go to listen to the guidance that he had. And eventually I had a group that I could go to, and eventually I had a higher power. And I found that the spiritual path, or this spiritual map, to be guided on there was very similar to when I went through instrument training in the military, in the Marine Corps, in flight school. And they suddenly said, okay, guys, now you're going to get in the plane when you can't see the ground. And you're going to fly out there, and there's two mountains and an airport in between. And if you dial in this frequency, there's an invisible radio beam that comes up into your plane. And if you follow that beam, it'll take you down right between the mountains, and the runway will be right in front of you. Now, I didn't stand up and go, what? An invisible radio beam is going to come up from the airport and I go between two mountains, like only a couple thousand yards on either side of me? You want me to fly in there when I can't see? I could get killed. I just said, what's the frequency? You know, I put my life on the line to the invisible radio beam. No questions asked. What's the frequency? Da, 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 da. Guess what? There's the runway. Come into AA. Well, we have this creator of the universe that can guide you as you go through your life. Creator of the universe? What are you talking about? You want me to believe in a creator of the universe? And there I sat, Now, if I don't do that, I'm left with me running everything. And so AA becomes a very result-oriented thing. When it asks us to believe in something, it doesn't prove that these steps work. We just go, please come to our meetings, and we're going to parade a show, little show-and-tell operation for you. Mary, get up and tell us a little about your story. You get up and tell us a little about your story. As you can see, these people are the same as you and are doing remarkably well by following this plan, this treasure map. How are you doing? And then all we compare are the results. I see, we're very happy. And you? I see. I just got a nice job. Where are you living? And nobody discusses theory anymore. They just discuss results. It's totally unfair. When you're new in AA, you never win an argument because they keep going back to results. And I remember trying to discuss some, you know, I graduated from Yale and I got off to this military thing and all that, and I thought it was pretty smart, and I would be at meetings and people would go, we don't want to hear from you. And, I had all these ideas that I thought people might be interested in. And I remember talking to my sponsor afterwards, said, how come people don't want to listen to me? They said, you're wearing a wristband from a nut ward. And they don't think that would be a good person to listen to. So the words. So it's results, results, results. And I thought that was totally unfair because I had no results, but I had a lot of words. So this started this little process that I'm talking about. And I was looking for what the treasure was, since I'm using this analogy of treasure map. And I found it on page 25, so I brought it with me. I brought the big book with me. After all, it is our treasure map. And on 25, and this is what I'm saying, I knew how I wanted to lead into this. The first 5 years that I was in AA, the old-timers in Washington, D.C., they had a very simple program. Put the plug in the jug and go to meetings. Put the plug in the jug and go to meetings. Well, that's what I would call a very limited program. There wasn't any steps involved. You just put the plug in the jug and you went to meetings, and they would look at each other and they would say, after all that AA promises is sobriety. You ever heard that? All that AA promises is sobriety. Well, if that's what you believe, that's all you're going to get. Because we get what we believe. Now, I would say to anybody who thinks that all AA promises is sobriety is, have you ever heard the promises read? They go a little beyond sobriety, don't they? They talk about some huge things. They talk about things happening at the same level that they happened with three drinks. Self-seeking will slip away. Fear of people, economic insecurity will leave. These are all huge things. I sometimes wonder, after we read all those just remarkable promises, and then we say, are these extravagant promises? We ought to yell back, you're damn right they are. We go, we think not. I mean, did we ever read them? Those things are remarkably extravagant. But what does it say? They will materialize, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, but they will always materialize, but then there's that clincher. If we work for them. So that means we got to take a seeker. And that was the same thing at the end of chapter 5. We started out with, we're alcoholic, couldn't manage our own lives, went over and saw Dr. Young. No human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And I used to think that C said, and God couldn't would. End of statement. But there's a thing on the end of that, right? If he were sought. So what is sought? That's what we're getting to, I think, here. Do you believe in this map? Do you believe what's contained on page 25? 25 is in the chapter, There Is a Solution. And but we saw that it really worked in others, and we had to come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. When therefore we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, doesn't say anything about them solving it, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. So we pick up the simple kit of tools, and look at the next sentence. We have found much of heaven, and we've been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. It kind of reminds me of back when I was a teenager, and I was afraid to go out and ask the girls to dance, and somebody came up and said, "Well, just drink this." And they handed me a glass full of whiskey. And I went, "Drink that and I'll know how to dance?" They said, yeah. There's about 15 dancing lessons in that one glass. Isn't that similar to pick up this simple kit of spiritual tools and you'll be rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence? I'm going, 15 dancing lessons in one glass? Yes, the 15 dancing lessons there. What if you never drank it? And you're 70 years old today and you're telling some other old guy, "You know, when I was 15, some guy told me there were 15 dancing lessons in a glass of whiskey." There were, weren't there? It was there. The power was there. But if we didn't do it, we never got out there to see what was going to happen. So now we come down to what I think is the bottom line in the AA program. The great fact is just this, and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude towards life, towards our fellows, and towards God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. The absolute certainty that the Creator of the universe has entered my heart and is now doing for me what I couldn't do for ourselves. So I look at myself and I go, do I have the absolute certainty that this Creator has entered my heart? And if I say no, I don't know if I have sought hard enough. Have I settled for just sobriety? Have I settled for the amount of energy that my group can give me? We call this a we program, but it's individual results. What I think the we program is to talk us as individuals into taking individual action. It's only an individual who can go and get a sponsor and take a fourth step and a fifth step and plow through amends and do this basic work. But if you don't believe that this end result is there, then you'll never do it. And so it's so essential to see what this program wants us to believe in. It wants us to believe that there is in store for you something beyond your wildest dreams. It's for you to go get. It's right there. And so I thought about seeking. And the first time I heard the word seek, I don't know about you all, the first time I heard it was in grammar school. And they came up with a game called hide and seek. And I said, hide and seek, what the hell's that deal? And they said, well, Mary's going to hide, and then you try to find her when she's hidden. And we tell you to start looking. Oh, great, sounds like a great game. So I ran out. Okay, where is she? What did you, I don't know about you. Give me about a minute and a half. And then I go, oh, the hell with Mary. I looked everywhere. She's not there. You know what I mean? So I could stay interested in hide and seek, maybe a minute and a half, 2 minutes, something like that. And then I said, enough of this seeking. Let's go play baseball. I'm tired of seeking. But then came a higher level of seeking. That was when Easter, first Easter basket, and it was about 3.5 pounds of solid chocolate. And my mother said, I'm hiding these baskets. They're full of candy, just tons and tons. As soon as you find it, you can pig out all day eating that candy. Now I'm on a little higher level than finding Mary. And I could go maybe 20 minutes, you know, out in the yard or him. But even then, with 3.5 pounds of chocolate waiting for me, I'd start fading. I don't know about you. Do any of you fade? And then I'd go, am I hot? Can you give me a clue? Can you? Am I in the right room? You know, I'm getting tired of this seeking. It's kind of boring after a while. And so maybe 20 minutes. Maybe some of you could keep going longer, but I was in probably an Easter basket. 20 minutes, forget it. My sister can have the candy. You know what I mean? It was like, that's that. But then when I was about 16, we had a golden retriever. And we had had him about 5 years, and he ran off and never came back. And I came home from school, and I said, where's Towser? You know, and they said, he ran off. The last we saw him, he went in those woods. And he didn't come back. He didn't come back the next day. He didn't come back the next day. I can't tell you how many years I would drive up to those woods and look in there thinking that maybe today he's going to come running out of there. And I'd call his name. And I think even now, if I go back to my hometown out in Woodbridge, Connecticut, and drive down that road, I always glance over. I wonder if that dog, you know, he could still be there. I mean, it's possible. I was looking. Now, that is seeking at a much deeper level. So now we're coming to this. We're talking about this incredible treasure that's waiting for each one of us. I think that my favorite story about myself was when I was a little boy. And my friend, his mother, told this story when I was probably about 15 or 16. And it was one of the neighborhood get-togethers. She said, oh, I know a little story about little Sandy. And I go, I don't want to hear that story. But, you know, you got to sit there and hear it. And the story was about, back then we listened to when you got home from school, you listened to the radio. And the Lone Ranger was on. And that was one of my favorites, Jack Armstrong and the Lone Ranger, the 15-minute radio programs. And I got, if you mailed in 3 cereal box tops and a quarter, you got a gold Lone Ranger ring. And I had sent it in, and it finally came, and I put it on, and I ran around. I was the happiest kid you can imagine. This was the biggest deal ever happened. And I was over at her house, and she said, why are you so happy? And I said, I got a gold Lone Ranger ring. Do you want to see it? And I showed it to her, and she said, God, I hate to tell you this, but you see all that black stuff on your finger? I said, yeah. She says, well, if it was gold, it wouldn't do that. That's probably brass or copper. So that's really not a gold ring. And I looked at her, and I said, to me it's gold. And I ran out just as happy as I'd been in there. To me, it's gold. And so, when I was told about this program, that this, I saw that fourth dimension of existence, I just said, I think that's possible. I think that's what the goal of this program is. And then I saw people like Chuck, and I would just go, what has he got? What has happened to that man that is so remarkable? And I found out that he had just followed this simple kit of tools. So we're left with the question, well, what is the problem? Why are we not all there? Why haven't we all had this remarkable thing? And I suppose that question could be kicked around forever, but I'm going to throw out what I think is one of them. There is a part in the 12 and 12 in the sixth step where it says we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. And the question is, if we got entirely willing, would God take these all away? And we'd all be as happy as we could be. I mean, you know, and the answer is yes, that'll happen. And the question is, well, then why don't we do that? Why don't we ask God to take away the rest of our problems like we do our drinking? Because with our drinking, we were able to get 100% willing to have that taken away. And it was. And that's what Bill writes in there. He says, now that we can see that, how come we can't do that with our other character defects? Because that's all that this is. The program, if you're new, is You're being blocked from this treasure. And your job is to remove these blockages, and you're there. That's the bottom line of the whole deal. And these blockages we label character defects, for lack of a better word. And everybody has the same character defects. We all were born with the same ones when we came into this planet. And the question is, why aren't we willing to get rid of them all? Everybody says, wouldn't you like to have your character defects removed? Everybody goes, yeah, I'd sure like it. I'd like it. Boy, I feel great. If I get rid of all these character defects, I feel like $1 million. Good. Well, what do you want to start with? How about lust? Would you like all your lust removed? All? All? All. What would all be? What would zero lust be? So you go talk to some of your buddies. Have you ever had all your lust taken away? And they go, no, it would probably be dangerous. I think that would be a bad thing. You want to get rid of most of it, but you don't want to get rid of all of it. I think that happens when you die. That's what I think it is. I think that would be going a little too far. So what you should pray for is to get most of your lust removed. Oh yeah, that makes more sense. Because who wants to be that extreme? So what I like to do is to get rid of most of my lust. Okay, well how about greed? You want all your greed gone, then you wouldn't be, you know, looking out for yourself and trying to go one up on the next guy. You are in business after all. Once in a while you do have to, you know what I'm talking about, don't you? Or you won't make it through. You're not going to totally rely on God financially, are you? You have to take a little responsibility for yourself. So why don't we get rid of 80% of greed? That would be a good thing to get rid of, is 80% of greed. And while we're at it, I had a complaint about your gossiping. Don't you think you really ought to get rid of that? Don't you agree that that is really something that has done a lot of harm? And you go, yeah, I'm getting rid of that. That is terrible. The fact that I do gossip once in a while, it tears down the other person. And then you start thinking, you go, well, I'd like to give up originating gossip, but if I'm just passing on something that someone else said, then technically I'm not the gossiper per se. I'm just a messenger of, and I don't think that really is a violation. And so I would like to give up originating gossip. That's what I would like to do on this step. And then as we go through the sixth step, we find that nobody is entirely willing to get rid of any character defect other than drinking, because drinking is killing us. So Bill writes, well, now we're stuck with the assignment for the rest of our lives. And so if you see, the job isn't to become a better person. The job is to become more willing. The job is to pray for the willingness to get rid of something else and something else. And then we get to move further along on this map and get closer to this treasure. And I think it is the adventure of the lifetime in AA, and the victories over our own willingness. Sometimes we talk about things happening in God's time. Have you ever heard that expression? Well, it happens in God's time. It happens in God's time. Maybe you're lonesome and you want to get God's help. You know, I'm so lonely. I'm tired of sleeping alone. I'm lonely. So God, please help me meet somebody nice so that I can spend time with them and I won't be lonely anymore. Well, we just ask God for something that's going to take time. So 6 months later, we meet somebody and then we get comfortable. Maybe about a year later, we go, you know, God finally answered my prayers. Everything happens in God's time. The person next to us had the same problem. They said, I'm so lonely. And they said, God, would you take away this loneliness? And he did. They weren't with anybody. They just had their loneliness taken away. And that happened in God's time. So you can see sometimes we're asking for something that takes time. That was what we asked for. Hey, I'd like this loneliness fixed in about a year. Would you please help me? Instead of recognizing this is infinite power. Could you please take away my financial insecurity without giving me any money? We don't realize that we have access to power that is way beyond what we would normally imagine. And so I think the heart of the program is realizing that each one of us has that kind of power available to us. That we have a friend, our own creator, who is that close to us, just waiting for us to say, please help me. So how do you say help? And I'm going to close with this. Now try to think about how you could ask a higher power for help. And I think the best description I could give you, now that I look back over the years on how I've asked for help and how I ask for it now. I was in the Marine Corps, and one of the briefings, you get all kinds of training, I mean. And when I was being trained as an infantry officer, they said, now, when you get in combat, you could be out there and get seriously wounded. When you get seriously wounded, that's why we have corpsmen. You call the corpsman. And I remember saying to myself, well, I don't want anybody else to know I'm wounded, so I'll call the corpsman by going, corpsman, over here, please. Because I didn't want anybody to know I had a problem. You know, that would be the alcoholic who doesn't want to really ask for help. And the answer was, this is how you call for a corpsman. Corpsman! At the loud top of your lungs, you're screaming for help. When you scream that loud for God's help, you hear it. You hear yourself asking for help. Otherwise, there's part of you that's blocking it, doesn't even really want the help. You know what I mean? I think I want you to help me, but I don't want you to take it on my whole life. I don't want you to get too involved in my life. It's this halfway stuff, you know. I want us to keep park control, but I don't want you coming in. You get God all the way in here, he'll have you being like Mother Teresa. You have to give all your stuff away to the poor, and you won't go bowling anymore. You know what? So you got to limit how much help you get. This is the thing that goes on, and I suddenly realized that is just crazy. And so now I say it loud enough so I can hear it, and maybe the people upstairs can hear it. Help! With real loud voice. And guess how quick the help comes? Now. Now. I believe honestly that this help is that available. And I know I've wandered in circles this afternoon. I didn't have anything really prepared, but I just wanted to share some of the thoughts that have been racing around in my head in the last year or so. And I thank you for your attention, and God bless all of you that are new. Thank you.